Thanks for downloading the Overdrive podcast. Do not forget to follow us on Instagram at TSN1050, where there will be Insta stories, some best of clips from the show, and some very cool contest opportunities to win tickets and more. Again, on Instagram at TSN1050. Brian Hayes and Dave Festruck in here from the Star. Steve Phillips later in the hour, around 6:30, on reports out there that maybe John Gibbons and the Blue Jays will be going their separate ways by the end of the year. No one's surprised by that. I don't think anybody's surprised by that. So we'll get into that around 6:30. Jays back in action tonight. Marcus Stroman on the mound, who is still an intriguing part of this whole season for me.
Oh, yeah.
Is watching Stroman pitch. You know, beyond that, there's not much unless some kids start coming up in September, which some kids will come up. I don't know if it'll be Vladdy Guerrero Jr., but there will be a couple of prospects that will come up. But watching Stroman, because of who he is, he's an easy guy to gravitate to, whether you like him or dislike him, and his numbers have been so bad. He's coming off an awful start the last time he was on the mound, and now you got Boston in town waiting for him.
Oh, yeah. He's all about, you know, the chip on his shoulder and height doesn't measure heart. But I'll tell you what they do. I'll tell you what they do measure, the ERA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a big number, and now his is ballooned to 5.63. At age 27, he's not a kid anymore. Are we starting to see who this guy is? Maybe a guy who won't have the longevity in the major leagues that the Blue Jays hoped he would have. Maybe a guy who is living up to that idea that it's very tough to pitch at that height, whatever he is, 5.8. In the big leagues for, you know, for a long term. I mean, just haven't been many guys who've done it. You know, you just don't see longevity from smaller pitchers in the big leagues. And here he is. What is he now? 5 years into it.
27 years old.
And it's coming unraveled this year anyway. Maybe it's 1 year. Maybe he'll get back to what he was. Yes, last year when he had a much better ERA, 3.09.
Well, that's been his career in a nutshell, yeah. Though. There have been a lot of ups and downs. It's been a roller coaster ride with this guy, including in 2015 when he blew his knee out in the spring, and people were bracing for him to be the workhorse and the stud of that staff. And to his credit, man, he was grinding, he battled, he worked his way back.
It was a great story.
An incredible story. And that's what put him on the map here.
Yeah.
Not being a first-round pick out of Duke, not a guy who came up in May, I believe, the previous year, and put up good numbers, and people were prepared for him to be a legitimate pitcher in the major leagues. But the story of perseverance, the story of, it was like a Hollywood type of script.
Yeah,
like,
he comes back up after all that rehab at Duke.
And then start at Yankee Stadium when the Jays were battling the Yankees for who was going to win the division.
And he's a New York guy.
New York guy.
That's a New York cop.
Yeah, I remember it. I was down in Niagara Falls at the time, and we made sure that we got to a bar to watch the game.
Yeah.
Because Stroman was coming back. And Jays fever was lit up at that point. They ran roughshod over the American League in August, and this was early into September, and it was the Yankees. It was the most amplified series in 20 years.
Yeah, it was.
Because it was actually an important series against the Yankees in September.
You're right. It reminded people in this town who'd sort of forgotten what it was like to play in an important game in September, what it was like, right? And that was the beginning of the fever that was those two seasons.
So Stroman on the mound tonight, going up against Pomeranz, but that's not the real battle. He's going up against Mookie Betts and then Benintendi and then Moreland, and then, you know, they're lights out right now. Maybe, J.D. Martinez.
When you're talking about a franchise that's been around a century plus and they're talking about this might be the best Red Sox team ever. You know, I mean, at least in terms of their win total, what they're projected to get to into the, 110 plus range.
113 wins is what they're projected to get to right now. They just picked up a 4-game sweep against the Yankees, and it felt routine. That's the Yankees.
Yeah.
Like, they're up, 9.5 games on New York?
They're up nine games
on New York.
They're up 27 games on the Blue Jays.
It's August 7th.
That's what I mean. There's a lot of games left.
Yeah.
You know, the gap could get bigger.
It probably will. I mean, let's be honest. There's a good chance that it actually will. So, Steve Phillips a little bit later in the hour. Joe Banner, NFL analyst, will join us here in a moment. He was in Canton over the weekend, so he was there, even though he wasn't being inducted. Terrell Owens was not. T.O. was down in Tennessee. And there were reports out there that the Riders were actually working out Terrell Owens.
Yeah.
T.O.'s spoken about it, the idea that he wants to keep playing football somewhere, whether it's in the CFL, the Arena League. He knows the NFL's never coming calling. That's not going to happen. And I don't know how it would work with the CFL. And I think he'd probably look pretty old pretty quickly and really rusty, and it would be an ugly scene. But I'd support it anyway because of what we just went through with Manziel. The stats are irrelevant in terms of the hype and the buildup to the game.
Yeah.
And as a wideout, he's never going to have as bad of a performance as Manziel because there's nothing that's comparable. You know, you can't throw. What is the comparison of throwing four picks for a wide receiver in their debut? I don't know what that would be.
Five drops, you know. Maybe more than that. You're right. It's a disastrous debut for sure. But you're right. Like, this is a league where they can't be choosy. I mean, when you're talking about big names, this is what the CFL's lacked. And for, you know, the casual fan that they're trying to draw to stadiums where, you know, attendance is down in a lot of places, you can't look at Terrell Owens. Look at him. He's in great shape. Apparently, he's running a 40-yard dash in the 4.4 range, even at age 44. He'd probably be terrible. There's no doubt. How many 44-year-old guys can go out there in anything but a beer league and do well? On the other hand, why wouldn't you try?
Why not give him a shot?
Yeah.
You can always just cut him, right?
Exactly.
If it doesn't work out, you can just cut him. And, you know, if it doesn't work out, he'd probably pull the shoot. He'd probably be like, it's not working out for me. I want to get back home, whatever. But I don't think it's about the speed. I don't think it would necessarily be about his hands, although you always hear that from older guys, that it's actually the hands, the hand eye that kind of goes first.
Oh, yeah.
So that probably would factor in. Can he actually pull in footballs the way that he did throughout his career? But I think it's more about, is he willing to get hit? You know, like, that's the big question. At 44 years old, great, you can run a 4.5 40 or whatever, but are you willing to get laid out coming across the middle to make a play? And you can't really know that until you actually get in the game. And with the CFL, they don't practice in pads anymore. They're not going to just line them up and lay them out just to try to prove something. You'd have to sign them and see it before you could really know.
Well, you'd hate to see him laid out going across the middle in his first game, as clearly the guy who doesn't belong there is getting you know tossed back into 1991 by somebody who's happy to see him as a target.
Oh, and he would be targeted.
He would be a huge target.
Absolutely. Here's longtime NFL executive, current NFL analyst. He was in Canton, I believe, over the weekend. Back on Overdrive, here is Joe Banner. How you doing, Joe?
I'm doing great. Good to be with you guys. And I was in Canton. Special place.
Yeah. Well, what do you make of that Terrell Owens story, the fact that he decided not to show up and do it his own way? How do you feel about the blowback from that story?
You know, I think it's unfortunate. I mean, I think he's fought for more respect through his career, and he was finally on a stage where, I mean, the adulation and the thrill and the joy and the emotion these guys feel, having been there and close to Brian Dawkins and having seen it in the past, you know, I just think he missed a chance to have a really, really special time. You know, I certainly agree he can do what he wants, but just having been there this weekend and talked to people in the past who have been inducted, it's just such a special moment, and to share it with your family and your friends, the people that got you there. You know, I think he doesn't know what he doesn't know. So since he doesn't know what it felt like, he maybe underestimated just how special it could be.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Joe, but did you hear what Terrell Owens had to say in his speech in Tennessee, where he basically made the point that he didn't go to the Hall of Fame because he felt it was arbitrary and against the spirit of the Hall of Fame, that he was denied access or denied entry, induction into the Hall of Fame for a couple of years, when clearly he belongs there as one of the greatest receivers in the history of the game?
So, you know, you can spend your whole life fighting to be right, and one could argue he is in this case or he isn't. I think there's a valid case to be made on both sides. By that, I just mean that it didn't happen in year one versus he got inducted. Or at some point, you can just start to take some joy in what you've achieved and people that want to acknowledge you and moments that are just so few people. I mean, there's only 300 people in the Hall of Fame and him playing football for a very long time.
Yeah.
So, you know, at some point, there's value in being right, but at other points, there's value in just kind of stepping back and enjoying the moment and having a very, very special opportunity.
With Joe Banner, longtime NFL executive, and now the backlash from him not showing up, even though I believe he's the only guy who's living that decided not to show up, They're thinking, or there's some chatter coming out of the weekend, that they are going to make it mandatory. If you want in the hall, you got to show up for this weekend. That seems like an overreaction to me. How do you feel about it, Joe?
Nah, I'm with you completely. I think that's ridiculous. I mean, that, you know, if somebody thinks there's some reason to reevaluate the way people are elected, you know, there's never anything wrong in my mind with looking at how can you be better or can you be better. But to change the things as they're talking about and make that kind of a rule and make people sign something, I just think that's just ridiculous. I hope that the cooler heads will prevail and nothing like that will happen.
Well, this has always been my problem with the Hall of Fame. It's not only the NFL. It's the same thing. Cooperstown, the NHL Hall of Fame, is, you know, this idea that you're not really a Hall of Famer unless you're actually enshrined, where it just takes, it's actually about what you did during your career. Like, that's what makes you a Hall of Famer. It's what you actually represented when you played. And, like, baseball's the worst for this because of the steroid issue and how people, you know, feel about it. I don't care if Barry Bonds is in Cooperstown or not. He's a Hall of Famer for me, right? Like, there's no question about that. He's one of the great players ever. The same thing with Clemens, same thing with A-Rod in the future. So it always feels so stuffy. And it's so sanctimonious, and all these unwritten rules about you got to play by our rules, and you got to do it this way or the other, and you got to prove to us that you deserve to be in here. I thought the players proved it when they actually played. Like, isn't that when they were supposed to be proving it?
Yeah, it's like everything, though. You know, there's a subjective element to getting inducted, and you know, in football, I wonder if a group of writers and adding a couple of former Hall of Famers is the best evaluators. And I listen to people in football, which I think is different than the other games, try to make the case for who should be in the Hall of Fame purely based on numbers of whatever it is, passes thrown, passes caught, you know, sacks, whatever it is. The game is just so much more complicated than that, and the system should be more sophisticated in terms of electing them. But same time, once you're elected, you are in a unique position. You have a chance to create a thrill for yourself, your family, people that believe in you. I think all of us would love to have the opportunity to have that moment. I think it's too bad when you walk away from it.
So, Joe, while you were enjoying the festivities in Canton on the weekend, I guess it was Friday night, the football community was gathered there. There was a lot of eyes in Canada, at least, on Montreal, where Johnny Manziel was making his debut as a Canadian Football League starting quarterback. I'm wondering, you know, I know it gets some coverage on ESPN. How much was the football community, or how much is the football community tuned into what Johnny Football's doing up here in Canada?
You know, I think it's safe to assume they're keeping an eye on it. I don't think they're focused on it. I don't think anybody thinks there's a short-term path for him to get to the NFL, as much because he has to just prove who he is now off the field and can he sustain that over a period of time. But I think anybody that had so many people that believed in him coming out of the draft are going to keep an eye on it with the hope that maybe at some point he can reestablish himself. So I'd be surprised if at this point they're actually sending scouts or anything like that, but I assume they check on him, maybe check the tape, and at some point if he started to show some performances that they thought were strong, maybe send some scouts to watch in person. So I think keeping an eye on it without focusing on it right now would be the best description.
With Joe Banner, longtime NFL executive, there's some rumors out there, some reports out there that Odell Beckham Jr. and the Giants could be on the verge of a big contract that would make him the highest paid wideout in the league. I don't think there's any doubt this is a top three or top five talent for me, but you know, he's been somewhat of a distraction at times. He's had some injury problems. How would you feel about Odell Beckham Jr. being the highest paid wideout?
So he should be the highest paid wideout. I mean, I wouldn't fault any team for the reasons you just cited that said, you know what, he may not represent what we want, or we may decide that the risks or distractions aren't worth the reward. But if you decide that you think he is worth that, there's no question in my mind that, you know, the last contract of the top player is always the highest paid guy, and I think you can make a compelling argument that, as you say, he's certainly in the top three, and the other top two, three, four, five have recently signed. So I can't imagine him not doing a deal in which he doesn't become the highest paid guy in the league. Now, I could see the Giants being concerned with the structure. So if they do develop a situation where maybe he starts to act out more after he gets his money, that the consequences or the levers they have to, you know, keep him behaving properly are, you know, there in the way the contract is structured. But he's not going to take a deal in which he's not the highest paid wide receiver in the league, and I don't think he should.
You think that's... Do you understand why? I mean, the Giants are... Are they playing a dangerous game here, do you think, Joe?
Well, I wish we knew the details. And having been on the other side, there's so many times when the public thinks they know the details that they don't. I mean, you know, I read a report that they'd offer him less than Watkins as a starting offer. And if that's the case, you know, they're going to create bad feelings and they're going to alienate the player. And in my mind, they're kind of insulting him.
Yeah.
If they're truly committed to getting it done. And again, I have no idea if that report is correct or not. I actually know the reporter and have a decent amount of faith that she's usually very thorough and accurate. But, you know, I don't want to say when I don't know for sure. If I was going to go in there, I would start right away and just say, listen, we both know you're going to be the highest paid guy in the league. The only question is by how much and what's the structure. And hope that by setting that tone, we were able to kind of work together on the details and just get something done quickly. So I hope that they're not trying to play a game and wasting and creating a lot of negative energy over trying to save a few bucks in a deal that, whether it's, you know, 17.5 or 19.5, it's going to be within a million or two of easily guessed numbers. Why create a whole bunch of bad feelings about it when you're approaching a $200 million cap in the next probably year or two?
Thank you for doing this, Joe. We always appreciate you taking the time for us.
My pleasure. Happy to be on with you guys anytime.
There's Joe Banner, longtime NFL exec and current NFL analyst. And he's right about that. It matters when you come up. You know, if as long as you're within the top three, top five at your respective position, and you got some leverage, you got some power, and there's money available on that team, you're going to get the highest paid deal. I mean, you can argue whether it's Antonio Brown, Julio Jones, Odell Beckham Jr. You know, there's three, four, five guys in the league that hold that title as the best wideout and the most explosive wideout in the league. And Beckham Jr.'s in that conversation.
He's definitely in the conversation.
Yeah.
But he's also a volatile character, Hayes. And I wonder, I think Joe Banner's, I think, was onto something there. Like, if they're offering him deals that don't actually sort of put him on the pedestal he deserves to be put on, he's the kind of guy that seems like he might take it to heart in a way that would be counterproductive to the New York Giants' fate on the football field, I would suggest.
They're in a strange spot, New York, because they took Barkley with the second pick.
Yeah.
A running back who, generally speaking, I'm not a big fan of taking running backs that high in the draft.
Seems unwise.
Yeah. I mean, I know Ezekiel Elliott, for the most part, worked out pretty well. But you look at Trent Richardson, and I'm not saying that Saquon Barkley is going to be Richardson, but the Browns, of course, or was it the Colts? No, the Browns, of course, took him third overall.
Exactly.
And it was a bust for them. But you got Eli, who is old, he's broken down, he's not what he once was. They've restructured their offensive line, which was necessary. They had to do that. They had an awful O-line last year, but they've got some talent there. I mean, if Barkley can be a beast, which I think he probably will be, if he can be, you know, a dynamic back and you've got Odell Beckham Jr., you've got some pieces there. I just don't know what the expectations are without a quarterback that's going to be here for the next 5 or 10 years. Because at some point, they got to bring in a new quarterback.
They got to move forward.
Because Manning's not going to be doing it for much more than a year or two.
I mean, he hasn't been elite for quite some time. I mean, you take away the two Super Bowl rings, which, you know, no one's taking them away. But, I mean, his numbers in the regular season have not been elite for an awfully long time.
No, throws a ton of picks, tons of interceptions.
And now he's 37 years old, and, you know, look, it's understandable why people don't have any faith in this organization, why the, you know, I think, what's their Vegas win-loss total? I think it's, their win total's at over-under 7 this year. Like, that's bottom third of the league stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody believes this team's actually going to figure it out, no matter that they got one of the best weapons in a wideout in Odell Beckham Jr.
Yeah. See, I'm with you. I don't have a ton of faith in the Giants, but that division, it flips upside down every single year.
That's true.
Every
Very
single
difficult to predict.
Year. I don't believe they've had back-to-back winners in that division since the early 2000s when the Eagles, I believe, did it when McNabb and Reed were there. And maybe Terrell Owens was actually there at that point.
Yeah.
But
no,
every
it's a fine
year,
line.
It turns over, you know, and like the Cowboys, like the Eagles should be considered the top seed. They're Super Bowl champs.
How can they not be?
They should be. And they're bringing back a lot of the band. But we don't know what's going on with Carson Wentz. And I know what Nick Foles did down the stretch. But I don't know what he's going to look like to start the year if he ends up as the starter. It kind of feels like that'll probably end up happening. The Cowboys, what is Dak Prescott? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, Ezekiel Elliott, I got faith in. But do they have any options with Witten gone, with Dez Bryant gone? Offensively, I'm not sure.
Yeah, teams changed a lot. You're right.
You know, injury problems defensively with Sean Lee's a guy who can never stay healthy, and he is the linchpin of that defense. And the Skins are, you know, now they got Alex Smith and they're Washington. They just never, you know.
It never goes well for the Skins.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that outside of the Eagles, who you have to feel good about, I'm not really sure how you're supposed to feel about the other teams. That said, Cowboys fans, I know they're going to start tweeting in and start yelling and screaming that over the past couple of years, they've won a lot of games collectively.
Yeah.
They've won a lot of games. So, you know, maybe there should be a little bit more faith in them. It's probably just the Jerry Jones effect. You keep hearing him, and you're like, "There's, I don't want to root for that team. I don't want to believe in that team."
I think that's exactly what it is. Like, Jerry Jones hurts the case for the Cowboys so often because he's such a, you know, disingenuous, off-putting personality. From, you know, and his two-facedness about this this anthem stuff is a case in point. You know, where he was the guy kneeling down with in solidarity with the players. When this thing first became an issue, and now he's the guy saying, "No, we gotta kneel, and you gotta do what the president says." Essentially, I mean, this is gonna be sadly for guys like us who work on talk radio. That's gonna be the talking point for probably the first 5 weeks of the season, as Trump tweets and Jerry Jones speaks, and other players protest or players stay in the locker room to protest. I mean, that's what this league has become now. It's going to be a conversation that has to do with politics more than it is about football.
Very politicized. And I'm having a difficult time getting a read on how much the general audience really wants to hear it.
Yeah.
Which, again, is difficult to acknowledge because it's a serious topic. I mean, it's a very serious topic. And what the players are actually kneeling for, the reasoning behind it, what Trump's involvement in all this is, how Goodell and the owners are going to factor in. It's very complicated. It's very significant and very meaningful. But kind of like what we talked about last week with Urban Meyer, to an extent what we talked about with Roberto Osuna, who made his debut last night and pitched really well and got the win.
Yeah.
A lot of the general fans are just like, man, I just want to watch baseball or football and all. I don't really want to talk about all that kind of stuff.
Well, and that, as soon as a case in point, to your point, Hayes, like, you pitched in San Francisco, right? And there was no booing that I heard about. There was no reaction, really, to his entrance into the game in a negative way. I mean, so in other words, baseball fans were not outraged that this guy was pitching with charges in Ontario pending against him on a domestic violence issue.
Well, I guess we'll see what happens when he gets back to Houston.
Sure.
And when he's in Toronto later in September, right?
Well, that's a different story.
That's a very different story.
I think we can envision the reaction in Toronto in September for the handful of fans that will actually be in attendance.
I would assume if he gets in a game, he's probably getting booed.
You would have to.
I would think he'll more than likely get booed. But Houston, again, he made his debut last night. Osuna made his debut last night, and he pitched a clean inning and actually ended up picking up the win.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Houston continues to backpedal and dance, and they're trying to explain what this means and what they know and what their standards are. And it feels like they've kind of sold their soul here because they feel like this guy's going to help them win. And sure enough, what does he do when he first goes out there? He literally gets them
the win.
Literally gets them the win.
But there are those who believe he's going to, you know, upset the clubhouse chemistry to the point where they're not going to be able to defend this World Series title, even though they're one of the best teams in baseball.
Right, because you can tell, like, I think it was Bregman who came out. I thought I read a quote from Bregman today. He's a younger guy.
Sure.
But you know, I think he's been fairly vocal about it in the past. A lot of the Astros have been vocal about their stance on domestic abuse and domestic violence. And even you could tell just reading it how uncomfortable it was jumping off the page.
Yeah.
You know, jumping off Twitter. Like, I didn't even see it. I didn't visualize it. I couldn't see the video. I didn't find the video. I just read his quote. And you could tell that he was kind of queasy.
You're right.
You know, he's like, I guess I'm okay with, I'm okay with him being here. I don't really know what happened. Like, that's the stance now. I don't really know what happened.
That's what everybody is saying.
Yeah, I don't really know what happened.
We don't really know the details. That's what Verlander has essentially said. And he's been one of the biggest critics of players within the Astros system who've had domestic violence charges against them in the past. So you're right. It's a very dicey situation right now.
And which, again, is I feel for those. I'm not going to rant and rave about those players. You know, that it's not their position to explain what the team did.
No,
because they didn't make the trade. They just play for the team. They want to go out there and win. They want to perform for the fans, for themselves, etc. So they're in the most precarious position possible. Because what are they really going to say? I'm not going to blast them because they weren't being genuine or because they weren't being honest or they didn't say what maybe I want to hear them say or what whoever wants to hear them say.
But they're employed by the team that went all in on this guy.
Yeah.
So what, they got to in some way support the team.
He's here now.
Yeah.
He's playing for it. Osuna's playing.
They're not sending him back to Toronto anytime soon. I'll tell you that.
Steve Phillips, our Jays analyst, will join us on some reports out there that maybe Gibbons and the Jays are going to go their separate ways by the end of the year. What does that mean for Gibbons down the stretch? Who would be the go-to guy for him in terms of a manager going forward for this team? And try to get you more updates on what's going on with Donaldson, Sanchez, some news out there on their status as well. Overdrive continues on the TSN app. Jays Red Sox tonight down at the Dome. Marcus Stroman on the mound for the Blue Jays. And we had this conversation earlier. Dave Festruck's in here from the Star. For Jays fans, if you had to pick one team to root for, would you pick the Red Sox or the Yankees? And you said you'd go with the Red Sox, right? I think you said that.
I did. I think the Yankees are more hateable. And as much as you don't, like, I'm not going to embrace either team. They're the impediment to Toronto's success in baseball, and they will be for quite some time to come. I think the Red Sox are more respectable. That you have to, they earn your respect with the way they've run themselves since the Theo Epstein era, since they reversed the curse of the Bambino and won in 2004.
Yeah, for me, it's just about the collective sports scene in Boston that I can't continue to support. Not that I've ever supported it, but
yeah, I don't support it either.
I don't want them to see any more victories or any more wins or jubilation or parades. I can't deal with it anymore. I can't deal with another picture of a 12-year-old kid at another parade with a sign saying, "This is my 17th parade."
Oh yeah,
or whatever.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, that's the thing. I mean,
when you're
living in this town where you got a TFC Cup and you got an Argos Grey Cup, and then it's been a while.
That's what we got: an MLS Cup and a couple of Grey Cups. That's what I've seen in my lifetime. I'm 35.
Hey, the 1993 World Series,
couple World Series. You're right.
1992 World Series, but other than that,
throwback. Shout out. Here's Steve Phillips, our TSN baseball analyst. What's up, Steve?
I feel sorry for you guys. My goodness. I mean, MB is just, it's horrible. I mean, listen, right now, being in Boston, it's a pretty good run. They're on a nice run. You see the Patriots, what they got going on. The Red Sox look like a strong team. The Bruins, the Celtics, I mean, they've got a lot going on up there right now.
Yeah, they do, and that's why it's all jealousy and envy, like you said. It's steeped in envy. I mean, I can't believe the amount of success they've had, but I don't think people in Toronto are alone. Almost everyone looks up to Boston and the accomplishments that their four collective teams have put forth over the past 15 years have been incredible. And you look at the Sox, they're coming off a four-game sweep at home of the Yankees, 9 up in the standings. Like, does that make sense to you? Are they 9 games better than the Yankees, in your opinion?
No, I don't think so, but they're playing that way right now. Now, they've had a little bit of an advantage with the schedule. The Yankees have a tougher schedule. But coming into the series on the weekend, the Red Sox had only won 4 of the 9 games that they had played against each other. They were 4-5, but now they're 8-5. They sweep them. It did change the lineup a little bit. And yes, it was a sweep, but it really showed me how in games, so many times you get down to this critical pitch in this inning, in this play, and the game could go so much differently. You know, the Yankees had a couple times with bases loaded and never seemed to capitalize on it, and that seemed to motivate the Red Sox, and then they came right back out, put a crooked number up on the board. And it only seemed like, all right, game on the line, oh, J.D. Martinez is coming to the plate. Like, how'd that happen? That every time, the critical moment, I go, oh, J.D. Martinez has to be the guy. It's almost like they insert him when they want him. He always seems to come up, or Mookie Betts, you know, comes up. And they've got a lot of different contributions there. And I give Dave Dombrowski credit, because one area where I thought maybe he probably should have made a move and he didn't was middle relief. But his middle relievers did a really nice job. For the most part, they did a really nice job over the course of the weekend. And it looks like they're going to be okay.
With Steve Phillips, our TSN analyst. Yeah, I think they'll be all right. Jays, again, in action against Boston tonight. And as for the Blue Jays, it's not about wins and losses, as we know. It hasn't been for a long time. It's more big picture stuff. And reports starting to trickle out that maybe John Gibbons and the Blue Jays are going to part ways at the end of the year. There's been a lot of rumors, and no one knows if it's true or not. Gibbons isn't going to say anything publicly on the record, but that John Gibbons would be okay with moving on. Let's put it that way. Is that how you see this all playing out? Does it just kind of add up to Gibbons and the Jays moving on at the end of the year?
Well, the Blue Jays, let's make it clear, they don't have a managerial problem. So it's not like there's some dissatisfaction with the job that he's done and it's led to an unfortunate failure this season about where they are. I mean, it's clear, you know, the story's not that hard to sort through as to why they are where they are right now. Underperformance, injuries, setbacks throughout, and in a lot of ways, probably not the sort of roster that can compete with the Yankees and Red Sox. You know, you thought maybe they can compete for that second wild card, but they had everything go wrong. That's not on the manager. Gibby's been around for a long time. He signed in 1980, when the Mets, as one of the three first round picks they had that year. I signed in 81, so we go back a long way. He's been in the business for a long time. You know, he's been away from his family a lot. I know that's important to him, and it may be that there's some things he needs to tend to back at home that at least plays into this for him, where he's made some good money, he's had a good run, that he could probably step away and still absolutely find a job in the game if he wants to do that. He can go home for a couple of years, take care of watch the kids finish growing up, and then, you know, get back into the game then if he wants to. So, if in fact he's not back, my sense is that it will be a mutual agreement and that it won't be a flat-out firing of John Gibbons.
So, I mean, Steve, if you're looking toward next season, and we don't know what's going to happen with Gibbons. We're certainly not shooing him out the door here, but if they are indeed in search of a replacement for John Gibbons come the off season, I mean, in your mind, with a new era beginning here, hopefully, with the Vladdy Guerrero Jr. era, for lack of a better term, beginning next season, what kind of a manager are you looking for if you're Atkins and Shapiro?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, listen, you got Joe Girardi out there. You've got Tony La Russa out there. You've got Dusty Baker out there. You might have Mike Socia out there if he decides he wants to step away in L.A. And there's Buck Showalter might be out there. His last year on his contract in Baltimore. So there's a lot of really good veteran sort of managers. I always prefer, you know, guys who have kind of been through it before. Certainly analytics are going to be part of any manager that they bring in. Somebody who understands them, somebody who can communicate them, somebody who can speak the language, take it from the analytics people and translate it into player ease so players can understand it. And so my guess is that probably means a younger, sort of new wave manager. And so it may preclude some of those veteran guys that are out there. And it feels to me, listen, they brought in Terry Francona in Cleveland. And Terry is, a hybrid guy. He's the old school guy, but he's the young school guy. One of the best communicators I've ever met. And if they could get a guy like that, I think that kind of can check every box. That could be the guy managing them while they rebuild and retool. And then the guy who also could manage them once they're good enough to win. Those managers are hard to come by. Sometimes there are the rebuilding guys, and then there are the winning guys. My guess is that they probably go with more of the rebuilding analytics sort of manager in the beginning, see if they can't mature players and manager at the same time to ultimately figure out the win a couple years down the road.
Thank you, Steve. Always appreciate it. We'll do it again next week.
Okay, you bet. My pleasure.
Steve Phillips, our Jays analyst. Yeah, I mean, that's what we were talking about off the top at the 4 p.m. hour. They're going to lean younger. They're going to lean analytical, probably a complete 180 of Gibbons, which, again, Steve's right. I mean, the reason they're on pace for 72, 73 wins is not because of the manager. Just like when they were on pace for 92, 93 in 2015, it wasn't because of the manager. But this is a year where John Gibbons has been basically just given a clean sheet and just said, do whatever you want. I mean, he can do anything crazy and people aren't even really paying attention.
Well, that's the thing.
No one's breaking down.
There's no scrutiny here.
There's no scrutiny whatsoever. That's what I'm trying to get to.
27 games out of the American League lead, right? The American League East lead right now. 27 games out of the AL East lead.
He has no blood on his hands. None. And no. I'm not saying he should. I'm just saying more often than not, if a team is underperforming like this, at some point, someone's going to say, write a hit piece about the manager.
Right.
Or
and
go
I'll
after
tell you what,
him or whatever.
If he was a sanctimonious jerk, for lack of a better term,
he'd get it.
He'd definitely be getting it.
He's played this town like a fiddle.
He's
like
the
all really time
good old boy.
Everyone loves
friend
Gibby.
Friend to everybody.
Yeah, everyone loves Gibby. And that's a smart move on his behalf.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not saying that he's doing it from a disingenuous standpoint.
No.
By all accounts, that is who he's just a good old boy. He's a good guy, fun to be around, treats people with respect. I got a lot of time for that.
Yeah.
But what is setting up here is, this team is going to tell you, no, we didn't want Gibbons. If Gibbons decides, you know, I want out, you know, or if it becomes a mutually agreed to kind of thing, which basically means I want to keep my money, but I don't really want to be paid here.
Because he's got one more year guaranteed in 2019.
Exactly. And this is where there's a double standard here, because if a player was doing this, people would be going crazy. But a manager or a coach or whatever, they can do whatever they want. People are like, oh, that's great. You know, you're such a great guy. We understand why you want to leave. But if that happens, they'll probably announce it as mutually agreed. We love Gibby. He was great. We're going to go our separate ways. This isn't about him. And then they're going to hire the polar opposite of him. So how are they going to explain that they loved John Gibbons and what he was, if it gets to this point, but then they decide to hire the complete opposite?
Exactly.
Like, how will that add up?
Oh,
it'll
be talking out of both sides of your mouth. Just like the Astros. Yeah, we got a zero tolerance on domestic violence. Welcome to Houston, Roberto Osuna.
Right.
That, yeah, these guys don't have a problem doing that, Hayes, if you haven't noticed. You know, sports managerial types, they have the double talk down.
Yes, they do. And
triple talk, quadruple talk. They can do a million angles
every talk
and do it with a straight face.
Every talk. And it's speculation. Again, we don't know, but again, I have heard, I'm sure you've heard, other people have heard, Gibbons would be okay with moving on, and who knows. But as I said earlier, too, based on what we just talked about, the fact that there hasn't been any scrutiny, he hasn't had to deal with any tough line of questioning or any heat whatsoever, and he's still making good money, wouldn't you want to keep that job?
Yeah.
Like, this is a perfect gig for a guy to step into next year, where no one's going to be looking at you to change anything. The team is not going to have any expectations next year, barring miracles in the offseason, which nobody's expecting. Really, you're going to have one job starting next year. Can you make sure Vladdy Guerrero Jr. pans out? That's it. That's going to be the pressure next year for the most part. Whoever the manager is.
You're right. But that's the interesting thing, is that it's a different job suddenly. Suddenly it goes from being, well, we were sort of pretending we were contenders, and we wanted to raise ticket prices and keep Josh Donaldson and not trade, you know, the farm, in the illusion, what turned out to be the delusional illusion that we're actually going to be decent enough to get a wild card berth, which we know was nowhere near realistic. But now next year, the whole calculus changes, because it's not about that. Next year it's about, let's develop this young core going forward around Vladdy Guerrero Jr. and whoever else, whether it's Lourdes Gurriel Jr. or whether it's Bichette or Biggio or whoever, or Jansen at catcher, whoever it happens to be. We need a developmental model here, right? So what's that going to be? Is that going to be younger? Is that going to be a guy who speaks Spanish so he can communicate with some of your best core players? Is that going to be a guy who's more in tune with the analytics and more behind the analytics than maybe Gibby ever was? Although there's no evidence that Gibby was, you know, hugely anti-analytics, because certainly he was doing all the same stuff most managers do with shifts and relievers and all the rest of it. But yeah, I think they're going to change course here. And as you say, they may do it while saying, nothing against Gibby.
It's not about him.
It's not about Gibby.
Don't even think about that. Don't go down that line of thinking. But here's our new 35-year-old manager who's from Sweden and, you know, only looks at numbers and hates the media and is going to be an ass clown every single day with everybody.
Yeah.
But it's not about, you know, changing course. It's not about that at all. Time now for our best bets, brought to you by Proline. I'm going over the number tonight in the Jays game. The total's 9.5, over the number, fading Baltimore as I usually do. I'll take Tampa at home. I'll take Cleveland home plus. I'll throw a fourth game in there too. Seattle's got to get going. I think they get going with a win in Texas tonight. Throw down 20. You can score 118. You can find my picks on Twitter at TSN 1050 Radio and get way into the game with Proline. It's the sports betting game that lets you turn small wagers into big excitement. Proline, get way into the game. We'll recap a busy afternoon, and start teeing up the game tonight with the Jays and Sox, and quickly touch on the legacy of Stan Mikita, who passed away at the age of 78 today. We'll get to that next. All right, Jays, Red Sox tonight down at the Rogers Center. And Marcus Stroman on the mound. So he's coming off an ugly start. His numbers are not very good. We'll see what he's got against the best team in baseball tonight at home. The great Stan Mikita passed away today at the age of 78. And I don't know if he's underrated. He's a Hall of Famer. He's a great, great player. But you pumped out some of his numbers that I was not aware of.
Yeah, I mean, he was like his prime 15 years. I mean, his best 15 years in the league, nobody scored more. Like, I mean, we're talking like Jean Beliveau was in the league, you know, and near his prime. You know, Phil Esposito. I mean, this guy was absolutely killing it as the best centerman in the league consistently. I mean, four scoring titles, two Hart trophies as MVP. And I love the one, like, you look at it, like, there's 271 Hall of Famers. There's 128 numbers retired in the NHL or something around that. But how many guys have statues outside the arena, right? And that one, those two of him, Stan Mikita and Bobby Hall outside the United Center, they're just glorious.
They're like, very
they're,
cool.
They're beautiful in a way that, like, the Canadians do it well. I mean, Legends Row's been nice in Toronto, but they're smaller scale. But those are giant statues, and they got the red jerseys on. Like, that's actually, they're colored red in a beautiful way. They stand right out there with the Michael Jordan statue in Chicago. And those, you know, Mikita was hockey in Chicago. Before Taves and Kane, they only had that one championship in 61 for so long. This guy was incredible. And on top of being the most skilled guy they've had, he was a tough dude, man. Like, he was at or near the lead in penalty minutes his first handful of years at 5'9".
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. Like, his first 5-6 years in the league, which is when he really lit the league on fire, and they won that cup his third year in the league. He also spent his whole career in Chicago, and that's the makings of a legend in a town like that, where you spend 20-plus and you win a title. He won two Hart trophies. He won 4 Art Ross trophies. But what's amazing is, you just pointed that out, all those penalty minutes, and then he won a couple of Lady Bings later in his career, because he totally changed the way he played. Yeah. He was this tough, because that was the era, right? If you were a small guy, you had to prove that you wouldn't back down to anybody.
Yeah.
And then eventually, once you made your bones in the league, people leave you alone, and then you can go and play whichever style you want to play.
Yeah, he had a great line. I'm from St. Catharines. He grew up in St. Catharines. He's from, obviously, what was then Czechoslovakia. He came as a young boy to St. Catharines, Ontario, and ended up starring for the St. Catharines Teepees, or I guess they were Blackhawks by that point, back when the NHL teams essentially owned the junior teams. But the stories he would tell about the way he went to his daughter one day after a game. He had like 5 penalties, and his daughter said to him, "You know, why were the other guys skating around on the ice while you were sitting on the bench?" And it's funny how that story, he claimed that was the moment he realized, yeah, maybe I shouldn't take so many penalties. Like,
what am
I'm really
doing
good.
Here? Yeah, I need to be on the ice.
You know, like, it's amazing how you come to these realizations. And certainly there wasn't the scrutiny that, like, back then that there is today. So nobody, writers like us, probably weren't pointing it out to him on a regular basis. But, man, what a dude. And he had that line, you know, "You might hit me first, but I'll hit you last." And you know
that's
story.
Right.
You know some of those stories.
Oh, man, this is one of the most entertaining interviews I've ever done. This was with Pat Quinn years ago. This would, when we were still down on Queen Street. So we're going back 6-7 years ago now. And myself and Noodles were interviewing Pat Quinn, and Quinn was talking about his career, and he was a legendary tough guy too.
Yeah.
And Pat Quinn looked like one. You just mentioned Stan Mikita was 5'9"
or 5'10".
Pat Quinn was like 6'3", 210 when people were not that big playing in the league.
Annihilated Bobby Orr and all that. And
that's how the story got going. We were talking about him laying out Bobby Orr. He almost killed Bobby Orr at the Boston Garden. And then he almost got killed trying to escape Boston. It's one of the craziest YouTube clips you're ever going to find. But we were talking about his career as a tough guy, and just, you know, what the era was like playing in his career. And he mentioned a story about Stan Mikita. And he said Stan Mikita, one of his first games in the NHL, when Quinn was just getting into the league, Mikita cross-checked him in the face. I think he said he basically hacked him over the head. Like, it was like vicious. Like, in today's game, he'd be suspended for 50
exactly.
games.
Exactly.
And Quinn said he waited like 12 years to get him back, because he'd never forget if someone did that to him. And he ended the interview by saying, "I got him back."
Yeah.
Somehow, exactly. 12 years later, he lined up Stan Mikita in Chicago or something and just crushed him. And the gratification I'm sure he felt at that moment, that is old school toughness. Never let bygones be bygones. Never forget about someone who wronged you.
It's so true, man.
Imagine waiting 12 years on a vendetta, but it finally pays off.
It's just, you will never see it again. The guy, the most skilled guy in Stan Mikita also being one of the meanest guys in the league.
Right.
I mean, it's just hard to imagine.
And Paquin had to get him, and he finally got him. And Paquin passed away a few years ago, and now Stan Mikita passing away today at the age of 78. An all-time great. All right, Dave, you're back in here tomorrow, right?
Looking forward to it.
All right, man, we'll catch you tomorrow at 4 p.m. There's Dave Festruck of the Toronto Star. I am Brian Hayes. We're out of here. We're back tomorrow at 4 p.m. We'll chat then.